Welcome to UFO Think Tank Radio with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello and welcome. Excuse me. Welcome to UFO Think Tank Radio. I'm your host, Alejandro Rojas. So it is wonderful to be speaking with you all yet again today. And I have a great guest who is on a television show that you all love to death. If I said, what's your favorite TV show? Most of you will be thinking of this television show. Yes, that's right. It's Chasing UFOs. Actually, like my niece used to say when she was little, she'd say, actually, and she called me Nene, so she'd say, actually, Nene. So, actually, this is a show that I have not received a lot of positive feedback on. Of course, we've talked about it before because I was on it. And in fact, some people said that I was, that was their favorite part. That was very nice of them. And all I did was point, essentially. And I did have a line. Actually, my sister said, no, you had 3 lines. She counted them because I did say a couple other things like that. They kind of barely got in there. Anyway, I went sky hunting with these dudes. And at least I'll say this. They are some cool people. Especially, I mean, I don't know them all that well, but I do know Ben fairly well, and I know James Fox very well. In fact, I'll try to get him on the show. But we've got Ben McGee, the science guy from the show today. Now, he is a skeptic, but he is also a scientist. And as I've said before, I think it's really important that we engage and we discuss with scientists, and the advantage here is that Ben is very open to talking about this and talking about what needs to be done in order to establish scientific physical evidence in this field. Now, my argument is you don't necessarily need scientific evidence. I mean, you do. That's a goal. And my personal goal, I think that's extremely important. But we don't have it now yet. I don't feel, and we'll talk about that a bit today, is that the bar in science is really, really high. It's extremely difficult to reach it. And we'll even talk about how many of the concepts that we think of in science today have not met that bar themselves. But they still talk about it. It's still science. It's still something that's okay to talk about and to speculate on. And so is this field, of course, that many of us feel of UFOs. So we'll talk about that, how it is an important field, and it's important for us to seek science. But we haven't gotten there yet. That does not diminish whatsoever the importance of this subject, nor does it justify it being ignored by mainstream media or anyone else. So stop it now. So we're going to be talking to Ben McGee, the Chasing UFO science guy, in just a little bit here. However, before that, and I just decided something. I'm going to do this. I've been thinking about it, but I haven't done it. And this will be something exciting for the next show, and that is UFO news music. Because I do the UFO news part. You know, I should get some music. Like, of course, it's copywritten. I think if I, like, sing it, you know, or kind of do the sound, it's not, I won't be breaching any copyright, but like the news, you know, the da-da-da-da, UFO news. So I'm going to get some music for the next show and going forward, because that'd be a lot of fun. It's just honestly, and hey, I like Blog Talk, but when I push play on the buttons here, you might have noticed that sometimes I'll keep talking, because sometimes it takes some time before it starts, so I'll have to figure out how a better way to play that music. But I'll do that, and we'll have some exciting bah, 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 news music going into the news next time. For now, you're just going to have to settle with me saying UFO news. So, of course, we cover the news of the week For some shows, like last week, we talk about news the entire show. And we talked with Lee Spiegel. He's the UFO news guy. And he has a couple stories this week. Now, he told us he was going to be writing about this Swedish team, and he told us all about this, going to hunt for ghost rockets. So he did write about that, and there's a little video where you can go see these people. So that's a fun story. Nothing in the way of results right now. In fact, they said that the weather was too bad and that it was an exploratory mission. Now they know the conditions, so they'll keep at it to try to find something. And that's some remains of a possible crash in that area. However, Lee also wrote about some possible UFO videos. And who did he task to take a look at these with him? But Ben Hansen, who we've had on the show. He's our buddy from Fact or Fate, Paranormal Files. So Ben Hansen is FBI trained. He's a real great guy, and he took a look at these videos. So that's one of the stories that you can see out there. A couple stories that featured UFO people, kind of cool. The News Press in Florida did a story on my good buddy Morgan Beale. And in fact, we've had him on the show. He's a state director for MUFON in Florida. He actually also aids and helps out with the MUFON tech stuff. That's why I talk to him a lot. And he's a real cool guy. So they did a story featuring him and his work, and they took a picture of him. He's bald, and I think he chooses to be so. It looks like he just shaves because it's very smooth, his scalp there. And the picture's kind of funny because they elongated it, so he kind of looks like a conehead. That's not really the shape of his head. His head is actually very normal shaped, in fact. So, just so you're aware, he's not a conehead person or an alien by any means that I'm aware of. And so it's a great story. It's kind of cool that they featured him. Also, just today, the Star Phoenix featured a Canadian researcher, Chris Rutowski. So they have a picture of him. He's a fun guy. I'm pretty sure, I can't remember, it's probably been a while. I know I'm like 95%, well, 75% sure I've had him on the show before. I didn't get a check before this show because his story just popped up, so I didn't have time. But kind of cool. A couple stories about UFO researchers. And these are serious UFO researchers. Really cool guys. Other news going into the UK. A couple UK stories. First of all is a story from the Daily Mail. Lee and I talked about how they like to steal these stories, but this is one of their own original stories, and this is kind of cool. It's just the abundance, and there have been a lot of sightings in the UK, but the UK especially, people in the private sector, but also law enforcement, are using these quadcopters, these little helicopter things, a lot to fly around. In fact, there was a story not too long ago, but I think that was in Russia, where a video was taken of something flying around in the sky. It turned out to be one of these, and it was because they mount cameras to these. So film people are using them to like the case in Russia, film events from up high or do all kinds of different filming. People in the private sector are doing that. You can buy these things with cameras and lights attached to them to fly them around for fun and just to see what they come up with. So, and this was an incident where these guys launched 49 of them at once. So this was kind of cool. They called it a flying swarm. And there's some cool pictures because they show them lined up in this giant field. And then they took to the sky together. And it's wild, this box shape of these objects flying up into the sky, these quadcopters. So kind of cool. Technology is just going into exciting and crazy places, which we're going to talk to Ben about in a little while here. So that's kind of cool, but the point was that, of course, every time people do this, it creates UFO sighting reports. So they have been getting a lot of UFO sighting reports, and a lot of the local UFO researchers out there in the UK are saying, yeah, these copters are really creating a lot of reports. Other UK news, this scientist with the Royal Society, he's a royal astronomer. Yeah, so, you know, that's like for the Queen and stuff. His name is Lord Martin Rees, so he's even a lord. Very impressive. That would be so fun. I want to be Sir Alejandro Rojas. Do they have any Mexicans that have been knighted? The first Mexican knight. I think that would be important. Anyway, Mexican American. Chicano. That's what I like to be called. It's just Chicano because it's really, I'm third generation Mexican American. If you haven't heard that term, you're not sure. What the heck is a Chicano? A Chicano, man, we're the guys who have been here for years. We don't really know Spanish, but we've lived here a long time, and we've got our own culture in the Southwest especially, you know. So we're Chicanos, man. Anyway, that's way off topic. Sir Chicano, the first Chicano knight. That would be cool. One day. Dare to dream, but this guy at the Royal Society, he's your typical older white guy in the UK, so they hand out knighthoods like left and right to these guys, especially the scientists. But this guy's cool because he's a Queen's astronomer, so if she wanted to look in a telescope, you know, she'd call up this guy and he'd come out and, you know, bring a telescope, the Royal Telescope that's probably encrusted in gold and all of this fancy stuff, and help her out to watch and look for stuff. But he's saying that he thinks within the next 40 years, we will find proof of life. We will find extraterrestrial evidence, strong evidence for extraterrestrial life. So that's just interesting. He's just saying that we've got such an increase in the technology in these telescopes that very soon, you know, we're going to be able to see enough of these planets that are far off, we'll be able to tell in their atmosphere, you know, what gases are in the atmosphere to show whether there's not life on those planets or not. So that's kind of cool, huh? So, and then once they find hairspray, evidence of hairspray in the atmosphere, they'll know that that technology, that civilization has gotten to the level of technology where they've been able to invent hairspray. He didn't say that, but he does slick his hair back up top. You know, he uses some hairspray there, I can tell. But anyway, that's kind of exciting news that he would do that. And then the final UK story I have here, or is it? No, it's not. I've got two more, actually. The UK is crazy. The UK is UFO crazy. They have been for a while, and that's exciting. And you know what I always think about? We've got quite a few UK listeners on the show. And I watch a lot of UK. I love British television. I'm going to tell you that right now. I watch Masterpiece Theater every Sunday. Inspector Lewis, Inspector Morris, Poirot, Sherlock Holmes, Miss Marple. I love Agatha Christie's Miss Marple. Excellent, funny, intelligent. I love it. So I just want to say I love you guys. I love my British buddies, including Mr. Gary McKinnon. This is a gentleman, of course, who hacked into government, United States government files in 2001 and 2002 after watching the Disclosure Project, Dr. Greer. That's what got me into this, but I didn't, you know, break the law. I'm staying within the legal methods of trying to get this information out. He decided to push it. But of course, he says he was stoned and drunk when he was doing it, and it wasn't a good idea. But the problem is the military wanted to extradite him, and it has taken, for goodness sakes, over 10 years to figure this out, or about 10 years. Finally, they have set a date. They've been going back and forth. There have actually the prime ministers have brought this up with Hillary and Obama. So it's a serious deal about what to do. And they finally say that on October 16th, they're going to decide whether or not to extradite him. Obama said last time, at first, you know, in the George Bush years and stuff, they were saying, you extradite him or we're going to get so mad. We will be really mad at you guys. And the British are like, okay, gosh, chill out. And actually, Hillary Clinton, I think, said something similar, and I think Barack at first said something similar. But the last time Obama went out there and they talked about it, Obama said, fine, do what you want. Do what you want. Do what everyone. Who was that? Can't remember what rap song that is. Old school rap, 80s. Do what you want to. Let's have some fun, y'all. I think that's Kid and Play, actually. Anyway, so Obama sang the Kid and Play song, told him, do what you want to, and they said, okay. But they still didn't decide anything. This is like a couple years ago. So finally, October 16th, they're going to come out and say whether or not they're going to extradite him. If they do not extradite him, then they can try him there in the UK and decide how many years they want to give him. Hopefully the 10 years he's already put in will count. If they do extradite him to the U.S., the U.S. can convict him up to 60 years in prison and throw him in an American prison. And the U.K. are terrified. These British guys are terrified of American prisons because they're watching our TV shows. You know, they're hearing about dropping the soap and all this scary stuff that happens in American prisons. And they are terrified of American prisons, rightfully so. They think we're crazy. We're loonies over here. We're going wild. And so they're afraid of prisoners gone wild. And so they, of course, have really been fighting to keep Gary there in the UK. I personally, he broke the law. And he really didn't, people have debated what he found. He has alleged to have found some things, but has no evidence of finding anything. So he really hasn't done much harm. He really showed he was getting into computers that hadn't set passwords. He was using the password, for instance, and getting in. So really, these were bugs. There was no security on these computers, and there should have been. If he had really some serious hacking skills where he got into some stuff or caused any damage, I could see him they coming down on him. But he wasn't really malicious. He's trying to get out UFO news. So I personally hope they take it easy on him. I hope he stays out in the UK so he can still have the tea time in jail. And I hope they don't give him any more years than what he's already had to serve. He suffered a lot. So October 16th, we're finally going to find out what they're going to do. Also, the Herald Sun, this is another UK story, posted a picture of a UFO or possible UFO or a UFO because it's unidentified. I said possible because they put question mark. Well, if it's question mark, then it's unidentified. We don't know what it is. It's UFO. Those UK people got to let their newspapers know this. But this is some strange object over Perth. So it does look like around, it could be an object that is luminescent. Honestly, because it's round with this little notch on the bottom, I have seen something similar in really bright objects that are very far out of focus. So what this could be, but it does kind of have hard edges, so it doesn't look like it might be out of focus. I don't know. An interesting picture, though, but it's featured in a UK paper, the Herald Sun. So that's kind of interesting. And then finally, I lied. I do have another British one. But this was kind of funny, where interesting, I should say. The police force that guards Britain's nuclear power plants was asked by a UFO enthusiast, Ian Cambridge, out there, do you guys have a plan for aliens? If aliens try to steal nuclear waste. And their answer was interesting. They said, well, that's not our problem. We don't come up with plans. We just kind of are the guys on the ground. The people that come up with the plans are the special branch. Those are the intelligence guys that come up with plans to deal with different things. So it was kind of interesting that they decided to write a story on this. This was in the Londonbury Sentinel. And a couple quick stories. This group, they created a video called Extra terrestrial extras. I remember they submitted their film to the film festival at the International UFO Congress, although it didn't do too good, actually. But, you know, these guys seem to be serious because they put on a conference out in Kennebec. I don't know where that is. I'm sorry, guys. But they're putting on a conference on abduction. And here's a lady. See, here's a lady saying that she's been abducted, and she's got on a little thing with some springs and some alien things on it. I personally am not. I think if you're going to have something silly, have it silly. If you're going to have it serious, have it serious. If you're trying to convince people that you seriously have been abducted or you believe that to be, don't wear these little alien things on your head, because no one's going to take you seriously. And now you've got this picture of yourself. You're trying to argue that you're serious about your encounter, and you look like you're making fun of everything. And you're just joking around. Not helping your case. Sorry. Finally, in a paper called The Times Live, this is kind of weird because there's a total lack of detail in this story, but this is over Johannesburg. I guess last Sunday there were reports of UFOs, and it was all part of a Cartoon Network television stunt of some sort. They are having a show with some UFOs that are over Johannesburg, and somehow they did some sort of stunt, UFOs over Johannesburg. And so in South Africa, some people reported some UFOs, and they said, oh, don't worry about that. That was just our little stunt. But there's no details. What do you mean? What did people call in? What did they report? What was your stunt? What did it entail? Were you flying around these copters, or what's the deal? None of those details are here. There's a few short sentences. That's all this story is. I want answers. I want them now. I should sick Lee Spiegel on this. We'll see if I can, because that's his job, full-time job, looking stuff like this up. So do your job and get us answers, Mr. Spiegel. That's what I'm going to tell him. Oh, I'm all fired up. And I'm also fired up. I really like Ben McGee from Chasing UFOs. And we'll talk about the show because, honestly, he doesn't think the show could be all it. It wasn't all it could be. I'll put it that way. And so he expresses that to me. And let's hear it in his words. I am very happy to have on the show with me today Ben McGee, the science guy from Chasing UFOs. I think that's what my audience would know you best as. Hello, Ben.
Hey, Alejandro. How's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you on the show. I think that, one thing I was curious about is how they chose you. You know, you have a company, Astrolite, that does some spaceflight consulting, it appears.
Right.
So how did Chasing UFOs come across you?
Well, actually, sometimes I ask myself the same thing. I'm definitely, I'm not a TV guy, and I'd never been a UFO guy. And as it turns out, I've always been interested in space. My background is in the geosciences, but I did a lot of planetary geology work, so studying the way that, say, volcanism happens on Jupiter's moons. I've always been sort of space-minded. And I'd written a paper back in 2010 to the Journal of Space Policy on how you would actually perform archaeology on Mars. And it's a little speculative, but you call it xenoarchaeology, xeno meaning foreign, that's with an X. And it was a pretty dry paper. It really just said, you know, if a rover did stumble on something, that's the wrong moment to try and figure out how it is you're supposed to credibly study it. So I combined archaeological techniques with, you know, NASA COSPAR sample return protocols and then SETI message protocols and came up with some guidelines. And then I blogged about it. And as it turns out, there was a production company that was considering doing a reality UFO show. At the time, they wanted somebody to help lead a real geophysical investigation of alleged UFO crash sites. And they found my blog about, for what for all appearances seemed to be alien archaeology in a serious way. And they contacted me through my blog. They said, hey, would you be interested in you know, considering doing a TV show where you actually go out to the field, use geophysics, and see if there's anything to any of these claims. And one thing led to another.
Right. Cool. That's exciting. Now, on the show, see, now I guess there's a part of me about the show, because I get a lot of responses. A lot of my listeners have, you know, I posted something like the picture of me and Jason on the show.
Yeah.
And people were like, I can't even believe you'd want to be associated with that show and all of this stuff. But I guess I've known James for a long time. You and I hit it off when we got to do the filming.
Sure.
The group of people, you three, are just really cool, fun people. And I think that's what is a lot of the appeal of the show.
Well, yeah, and the show, frankly, evolved a lot through over time. I mean, we started, you know, concept discussions with me started way back in the summer of 2011. So, yeah, about a year ago. And no, wait, that would have, yeah. Yeah, even a little earlier than that, because we had some prelim discussions that spring. So basically, you know, year and a half, we've been talking about this. And as time went on, we filmed a lot of very serious stuff. And depending on how it's cut together determines how serious or lighthearted or sort of wry the final product is. And the show ultimately went in a direction where they included less hard stuff and focused more on the fun, on the entertainment factor.
Right.
And, you know, there's nothing we can do about that. And that's what ultimately networks decide to do when they want to reach the broadest audience. And, you know, we weren't a part of that. Our contribution, like, you know, you can vouch, we filmed that quite some time ago.
Right.
You know, after that, we really had no involvement. So,
know,
It's just, we tried to do something honest, and, you know, it certainly wasn't the intent to have it be received as anything less than that.
Yeah, and it was exciting that it, for me, that it was National Geographic, because they typically do science, and it would have, I was excited for the prospect to have a lot of geophysical science and investigation done, but unfortunately, there was very little to none that really actually made it to the show's final product, huh?
Well, you know, you can gain some insight. I was provided the opportunity to write a blog series on the Nat Geo TV website.
Cool.
On the science behind the show. And it ran concurrently with each episode, and that's where I tried to, you know, pick up off the cutting room floor a lot of the stuff that we did and reinsert it back into at least a narrative about what we did during the episode and help some of it make a little more sense for people who wanted some harder content. So did you have a chance to look at any of those?
No, I don't think I did see those, actually.
Oh, really? I'll send you a link. It,
yeah.
It may be – it at least justifies that we did do a lot of the scientific work that – like you said, you saw us do some, and that we thought might make the show, but ultimately it just went in a different direction.
Yeah, yeah, because one of those cases especially I was excited about, and I know because it's the Frank Kimbler with the metal and that he had found in Roswell.
Right.
Because he had some testing that indicated possibly that the material was something developed off the planet, essentially. And he needs another test to be done. And, so I know when James and I had talked about that originally, you know, we were both excited about the prospects of that, but unfortunately a second test wasn't done. And the first test wasn't even really touched on the show, unfortunately.
Right. And that's, you know, again, it's, you know, decisions beyond my, I'm a science guy. If it were me, I'd have science on every show, you know, packed wall to wall. But I really hoped that that beat would show up because that was one of the things I hoped to help illustrate. Because coming from a skeptical perspective, there are many scientists who study extraterrestrial material all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's done in the context of, you know, meteorite deposits, essentially. And how do you know that a meteorite came from the asteroid belt, or that it's a metallic asteroid, or it came from a chondrite, or it came from Mars? The tools that scientists use to determine the origin comes down to elemental isotopes, so different versions of chemical elements that are in a specific proportion in different places in the solar system, and that can act as a fingerprint. And Kimbler and I had hit it off fantastically, and we had a huge conversation over a hood of a car that scene was featured, but the content wasn't, where we talked about the idea of sort of planetary fingerprint. And his data at least suggested, you can't say much with one data point, mm-hmm. but it's possible that his data suggested a non-terrestrial source for the metal that he found. But again, without testing, that could still be within the error bars of something. But that was a point, mm-hmm. nonetheless, that I was really hoping to help bring out to people who have questions about this, and unfortunately didn't make the show.
What was the point that you could make that point here?
I'm sorry, say again?
That point that you were trying to make? What was it, just that about...
No, that was it. It was that scientists do study extraterrestrial material. You don't have to reinvent the wheel to try and determine if some sort of material came from off the world. We actually, geologists do that all the time.
Right.
I wanted to help broadcast that those tools exist. And if someone wanted to seriously study or seriously propose that something is from off the world, well, here are the tests you can do to prove it.
Mm-hmm. So, and Frank Kimbler is very knowledgeable. He's taught physical sciences. What would your advice to someone like him be, or maybe someone else who believes they have something like that? What steps would you take?
Well, I mean, essentially, I'd treat it no differently than if I thought I found a meteorite and wanted to figure out where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a full isotopic suite, try different isotopes, figure out what the material's made of, what mineral species you've got, and then be sort of dogged and relentless about it. There's no such thing as too much data. And you want to conclusively prove if you really, want it to be an extraterrestrial find, you have to really conclusively demonstrate that this material has an isotopic fingerprint is one thing you could do that clearly is non-terrestrial, and then publish it.
Mm-hmm.
Get it out there. Get it out in front of other scientists. Let them try and tear it apart, because that's the best thing they could possibly do. And this is one of the hardest things I had, one of the greatest difficulties I had explaining these concepts on the show to other people, was that you want to attack your hypothesis.
Right.
Because if it's true, it'll stand up to the most, dogged attack. And if it cracks, if your idea sort of falls down, where it falls down will actually tell you exactly what the truth is. So instead of, I see all too often people get very invested in whatever their find is, whether it's a unique video or some sort of object. And instead of attacking it, they're extremely defensive about it, which is sort of science turned on its head.
Mm-hmm.
And best thing you can do to bolster your own legitimacy and the legitimacy of any potential find, if you think you really have something, is to just attack the heck out of it and try and think of every way you could test to rule out that it's extraterrestrial. And if you can't, then you can prove to the world, look, I tried as hard as I could to find why this wasn't extraterrestrial, and I couldn't do it. So
right.
Try and see why this fails. And if everyone tries, then you might actually be looking at something.
Right, and I think that's a good point. And a lot of people get frustrated with MUFON, because really in our protocols for doing investigations, that's what we're doing. And they get frustrated with science, and they treat it like an enemy when, in fact, like you said, and I think you make a really good point that people don't realize, is that as a scientist, when you come up with a hypothesis, your next step is to debunk it, to do your best to debunk it, to prove it wrong, to find out if you can't. And so when people get frustrated when, whatever it is they feel is the case is being attacked, but that's science. That's what you need to do to build your case that it is what you think it is.
And you're absolutely right, and it helps you verify the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so what you want to do, you don't want to find one piece of data that finally may prove your case. That's called cherry picking. That's confirmation bias. That's actually very poor science, and that will lead you astray. The history of science is ripe with examples of people who cherry picked and then actually missed an even bigger discovery because they were so attached to mm-hmm. their hypothesis that they didn't follow where the data actually led, and it ended up leading to some even more fantastic discovery that they could have been on the forefront of, and because of their own bias, they weren't. So attacking your own hypothesis is also a way that science builds in trying to eliminate human bias. I mean, you can't really get there, which is why peer review exists. You want other people who don't have your specific biases to also look at whatever it is you're working on. But yes, when you're attacking, it's nothing personal. I mean, I really made some people angry when, you know, on the show, there's a strange light in the sky. Well, of course, to me, there's nothing about a light that demonstrates an extraterrestrial light. It's just a light. So when I started ruling against other possibilities, and if I found another one that fit, well, they accused me of the one having the bias, being the one to have the bias. When you know, if you've got two hypotheses and one of them has fewer assumptions than the other, well, that's the better, quote-unquote, hypothesis. And so you need to find a really good reason if, say, a light could have been, you know, Venus and a low angle on the horizon blinking a weird way. You need some really good other reason to say, okay, well, no, it wasn't Venus, and instead it was an alien spacecraft that traveled, you know, 26 trillion miles to come here and sit in the same spot and look, you know. It was nothing right. personal. I had no agenda to prove that extraterrestrials aren't here, but before proposing something like that, which has a bunch of unproven assumptions built in, you can bet the farm that I'm going to work my hardest to find more conventional explanations first. That's just good science.
It's funny because I had felt that when we went and we were doing our Skywatch, because we were both fairly quick to say, well, that's probably this, that's probably that, to the lights that were being seen, something, you know, right. mundane.
Right.
But you were like, well, that's probably what we think it is, but it might not be. You were opening up, and I could tell that it was like you were doing it for the benefit of the others in the group.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's I become a pariah, you know. Uh-huh. I'm the enemy within to a lot of these guys, because sure enough, you know, they really want to see, you know, I'm talking about like amateur UFO skywatchers. They really want to find an alien spacecraft. And so I'm the one who's always raining on the parade.
Yeah.
I tried to be really respectful during interviews and, you know, interactions with people, because like I said, I'm not out to make anyone feel bad or prove them wrong. Hopefully I can help show that there is a lot going on in the sky already that people may not be familiar with, and in that way help raise awareness of astronomy and, you know, meteorology and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was funny because that night, even, you know, because we kept seeing these flares over Goldwater,
yep.
Which was incredible. That was really great. And even James and Ryan and Aaron and my buddy Jeff, who was out there with us, they were like, oh, no, I don't know if those are flares. Those probably aren't flares. And I know you knew they were flares, but whenever you talked with them, you were like, okay, maybe it could be something else. And I'm like, what's he talking about? He knows those are flares. So it was kind of funny, but then I identified, okay, he's doing that because he doesn't want him to get all upset with him. Because they were insistent with me at a couple of times. Are you sure? I don't know. I don't think so. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, you're totally right, and there's a lot of politics here, too, which is that if I wanted them to even listen to me, then I had to really be gentle about saying, well, you know, you could be right, but why don't you look at the color? And that's the exact same color that you'd expect out of a flare, you know, what are the odds? And just find a gentle way to move the data in to get them to at least listen to reason.
Yeah, that was a cool, too, because, I mean, we were out there on these hills. Luke Air Force Base was below us, and then past Luke, way past, like 60, 80 miles, is Goldwaters, where they have these flares, which are really bright, lighting up over there. And I mean, they're to us, they're kind of small dots, but, you know, at least brighter than stars, but points of lights that are lighting up. And so I could see how, and that happens a lot. A lot of people mistake those flares for something. And some of the videos on YouTube I know now that people are excited about are those flares over Goldwater.
Right.
But then we got to see the jets come in, and you guys have that incredible lens. That was really cool.
Well, and that's, you know, unfortunately, almost none of that made it into the show, which I thought we had the full spectrum of potential sightings that night. We saw jets with landing lights coming in. We saw flares at extreme distance. We saw the, you know, bevy of conventional aircraft. We saw that Chinese lantern, and you know, we saw planets setting. We saw stars low on the horizon that
right.
started blinking strange colors. Really, it was, I couldn't have asked for a better sky watching night as far as collecting a library of things that people could see up in the sky.
Right.
And you know, I thought it was a kick.
Yeah, that was incredible that night that so much had happened. Like you said, a catalog of all these different strange things that could happen. And I was a little shocked that a lot of it didn't make it to the show, too, because it was kind of debunking the Phoenix different UFO stuff out here, UFO sightings out here. And those were perfect situations to demonstrate. I would imagine the footage you got of those flares was very interesting.
Oh, yeah. And again, you know, unfortunately, my involvement after we finished filming was really, I had no involvement.
Right.
So, you know, the show obviously, well, I mean, people have different opinions, but the show obviously leaned more, in my opinion, toward aliens are here and leaving the question open as opposed to showing all of that stuff to help educate people about, well, this is what a flare looks like. This is what a jet with a landing light at 20 miles away looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had such high-powered lenses out there. And, you know, unfortunately, I, of course, would hope all that stuff would make it in, but apparently that doesn't make for entertaining television. So,
right, and I always leave it to that, too. Look, I'm not, I know television, they have to get viewers. And these producers know how to do that. They've done it in the past, you know, they've created Snooki and all this other stuff
right.
people like to watch. So that's their job. They're going to, that's what their focus is going to be. And you can't, you know, think that it's going to be anything different. And then you just kind of cross your fingers. And I guess that's probably why a lot of people were hoping that, you know, National Geographic typically isn't in the reality TV show business. And this show was more reality TV. And luckily they had three interesting people to focus on, but
I appreciate that. It's you know, we gave it our best shot and we made an honest attempt. We went out and did a lot of science at these sites and talked to a lot of people, and
yeah.
you know, you can only fit so much in 43 minutes for each episode.
Yeah.
And we shot a week straight for each one, so you know, but National Geographic is moving toward the more reality show flavor of programming, which you can see with all their new shows that are coming out now. Apparently that's where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to Frank Kimbler.
Sure.
Because that is a unique case in that the isotopic research, like you talked about before, or analysis, is something that has kind of always been, at least for those of us in this field who are a little more familiar with the science, understand that's an important aspect. That's the Holy Grail. And it's hard often to get people to realize that. And at least Kimbler, being more savvy around science, it was great that he was able to go and do that test and then get these interesting results that he got.
Of course. I mean, I that shows a lot of credibility from a physical science perspective on his part. I mean, let me flip it over. How do scientists determine that something came from space when you find it on the ground? Well, you either can do an isotopic analysis or you can look for regmaglyphs, which are sort of scoop features in the surface of an item that are essentially melt marks from the heat of re-entering the atmosphere. Or you can look for something that, say, was molten during free fall and became a perfect sphere, like tektites from a meteorite impact. The only way you can make perfect spheres in Earth's gravity is if something is free falling through the air.
Hmm.
And so essentially it's weightless while it's falling, or it will make teardrops if they're big enough because the atmospheric resistance, or, you know, drop shapes because the atmospheric resistance bends it into that sort of shape. So, you know, there are only so many things, so many tools in the toolbox, so to speak, for determining that something came from space as far as physical science has it now. So those are the things that, you know, I wanted to help try and illustrate to people who are interested in this sort of thing with the, you know, not so secret ulterior motive of promoting planetary science. You know, let's get people interested who are already interested in the possibility of life out there. Well, let's get them interested in the sciences, including astrobiology, that are studying the possibility of life out there and studying material that actually comes from space.
Right. Now, in Kimbler's case, and just to confirm, it's still an open question, I guess that's the thing, and that's what's great about what he did. I mean, typically, you know, of course, because I've seen a lot of people who have found alleged material or material from the Roswell area that they believe to be something strange, and it always typically turns out to be something mundane.
Right.
And, of course, on first glance of Kimbler's material, I would have felt the same, but he knowing a little bit more about the types of aluminum that should have been in the area, then he went to do his test. And his test, at least, would you agree, makes this an open question that is at least worth exploring some more?
Yeah, I would say, you know, there's one data point does not a scientifically conclusive statement make.
Right.
And, you know, I want to be careful that in my opinion, I think that the difference in the isotope ratios in, I think it was magnesium isotopes, in the metal fragment that he found compared to what, quote, normal is not very far out of range. So it's still possible that you've got, you know, it's hard. The pieces are very small. There's not that much to analyze. And you could have error in there. So, you know, if it were me, I certainly wouldn't come out and say, I think this is alien. But definitely, if you have a reason to suspect, or even if you want to just toy with the hypothesis that, all right, let's see if this thing is actually from somewhere else, because so many people allege that something from somewhere else crashed here. Why not? You do it, consider it a, you know, like a scientific social service. There are enough people who are interested in this. Well, why not? You know, it's no skin off our nose to do an analysis. That's what scientists are for. So I would say, you know, get as many of these tests performed as conceivably possible. You want a huge scatter plot of data points that will tell you, even possibly from more than one lab, and that will tell you whether you're looking at something that looks weird isotopically because it was extremely manufactured on Earth. You know, say it's a very strange alloy, it went through some extremely protracted manufacturing process, or is it even farther out of range than that? And then you can start to really stick your toes in the water of, well, this may not have come from here. So one point is enough to raise an eyebrow for me. And certainly there seems to be enough interest. Let's get a bunch of tests done. Let's do it and let's see what the metal tells us.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. I like the way you put that, because certainly and at least, you know, when in my talking with Frank, he's from the same perspective, that he's not saying anything for sure, but as you said, it just raises the eyebrow. And there certainly is enough interest, and that's why I love what Frank Kimbler's done, or at least that whole case, is that it is an experiment in that he's going down a path that others should have gone down, so that all of us can learn from what he's going through. As to wherever it leads, you know, how to do this properly.
Well, and that's something that really, well, encouraged and discouraged me at the same time, because when the production company approached me and they said, okay, if you were going to look for material evidence of a crash of a spaceship in this spot, what would you do? And I said, well, I'd look at the topography and look at where runoff would collect, you know, metal fragments. I'd also look at how animals collect low-density pieces of material like burrows and anthills. And I'd even bring in some remote sensing, like satellite imagery, to see if there's any evidence of scouring or pervasive burn marks or something. And then they came back and said, well, as it turns out, we've been talking to this geologist who just did all that.
Right.
I went, oh.
Which is great. Yeah, he did those things. That was really cool.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think, coming from the background that I come from, I think it's more reasonable to first assume that we are looking, if it is isotopically strange, we're looking at an alloy that may have been involved in experimental aircraft, which would be no less interesting to me, and I know that would disappoint a lot of other people, but, you know, there are some people allege there are problems with the weather balloon explanation. It depends on, you know, whose data and whose versions of the stories you believe, but why not? Like I said, there are enough people interested. let's see what the metal tells us.
Yeah, well, that's helpful, too, though, to know that there could be this other explanation, which is something I hadn't heard before, which is that it is a very, you know, it's gone through some sort of manufacturing process that could affect those results.
Yeah, there are other ways to, I mean, it's difficult, and you're talking something that's very expensive and very sophisticated, but there are ways to sort of consolidate the isotopes of whatever chemical you're looking at. I mean, in a way, that's exactly what uranium processing does when you're concentrating different isotopes to make a nuclear reactor. You're stripping, you know, U-234 and U-235 from the U-238. But anyway, I mean, so there are ways that we technologically could also do something like that. But the point is, at this point, we don't have enough data to tell either way what it is exactly we're looking at. So, yes, data is never bad. Let's get more data.
All right, cool. Yeah, interesting stuff. So that's really cool. There's still more hope for the Kimmler case. So I need to get a hold of him and see how he's doing because I want to help him and keep that going.
Sure.
Okay, as far as the show, before we move away from it, was there anything, anybody you talked to or any information that you did find compelling?
Well, you know, it's a delicate question for me to approach because different things convince me as a scientist, or I should say different things are necessary to convince me as a scientist of the reality of something versus something that's just personally compelling because, you know, somebody has a very interesting story or a very heartfelt story. As far as physical evidence is concerned, I'm a little less convinced after doing the show that we are being visited by extraterrestrials than I was before. Not that I'm not open to the idea, and I didn't necessarily believe we're being visited, but, you know, there's a sort of vacuum of the sorts of physical evidence I would look for, like I talked about, to prop up the idea that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. But the most fascinating thing to me was to see how different cultures absorbed and kind of manifested the idea that we're not alone. And it was different from the United States versus Brazil versus Mexico. And, you know, in Brazil, there's centuries of history about aliens amongst us walking on the ground. And then, unsurprisingly to me, with that in mind, the Varginha crash in the late 90s involves aliens walking on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that you find in the United States, and I think that says something about the culture. One thing that I found very encouraging is that there are so many people now who believe we're not alone. And let's stop and think about that for a second. This has got to be the first century in human history where that is the case. There could even be 50% or more of the human population who believes that we are not alone, the Earth is not the sole producer of life in the universe. I mean, what have, you know, traditional religions done throughout for millennia? They've said, we are the point. We're the center of the universe. We are the light. We're the reason the Earth is here. And to have culture all over the world suddenly drift to territory where the Vatican has declared, hey, we're probably not alone. Astrobiology is the main reason we're going to other planets, and then just the word on the street, no matter where you go, half or more people say, you know what, yeah, we're probably not alone. That's astonishing. And that, to me, as a scientist and you know, astronaut hopeful, that's why I've been doing what I want to do. I want to get out there myself. It's incredibly encouraging. The idea that you might have a critical mass of essentially social support for going out there and engaging because we are probably not alone. That's the first time in human history I think that's happened. And so what I take away from the Chasing UFOs experience is this sort of encouragement that there is so much pervasive belief, even if it's not very strong belief, but pervasive belief that we're not alone. This is new territory, as I understand it, in the history of humankind.
That is an interesting observation because it is a milestone. It is, I think, it's certainly worth noting, And it is something that, especially for space geeks, where I'm sure you're excited about Star Trek and stuff like that, it is another step towards, you know, humanity moving into this sort of universal mode where we are one day to hopefully, you know, maybe interact with other intelligences or at least discover evidence of other intelligences. So, I mean, it's exciting in that way. I mean, in that it opens up, it changes us. I mean, I think it's almost like a point of evolving. Our perspectives have evolved from Earthbound to more cosmic.
Yes, and that's, you know, there's so many societies that are aspects of ours included that are very anti-science, and with that in mind, to have this dichotomy where you simultaneously have people who maybe a majority even that turn around and are influenced by science enough to say yes, we're probably not alone. You know, that's incredibly powerful, and I think reason to be very encouraged as, like you said, a space geek, a space scientist, somebody who believes that, you know, it's very important for us to get out there for a number of reasons.
It's funny too that you mentioned that, because this is a perspective that science is really the ones banging the drum on this. They're the ones at this point, which wasn't the case maybe even 5-10 years ago. But at this point, they're really drumming, you know, banging the drums out. You know, there's probably life out there.
Yeah, and, you know, this is part of the divide that I wanted to try and help bridge by doing the show, which is there's a difference between, I think most scientists would say, yeah, statistically, we still don't know. Life could still be rare, and that's still on the table. But with Kepler finding thousands of candidate planets out there around other stars, the likelihood is going up that we are more, you know, the principle of mediocrity says that we're probably not special, because there's nothing apparently special about our star or our position in the galaxy or anything like that. So there are probably lots of our sorts of solar systems out there, and life could be possible. However, that's a very different thing than saying alien life is here.
Right.
And so that's the divide that I think separates the ivory tower that really disenfranchises everyone who's interested in UFOs when scientists go, oh, bah, there's no such thing. And then people go, well, wait, why? You know, NASA's the one telling us that life's probably out there. What are you guys doing? It seems contradictory.
Right.
The point is there are lots of steps in between life has evolved somewhere else and it is here. And lots of those steps are unproven or unknown. And as a scientist, that's what you can't jump over to say, I saw a strange light. I can't find an easy explanation for it. Therefore, aliens, because we can't get past all these question marks. You know, as a scientist, you really have to address each one before you conclude something like that. So, and to me, one point I wanted to make also is that, and this relates to xenoarchaeology, the conceit of time. I think there is a conceit built into the idea that we're being visited by UFOs right now, which is the idea of geologic and cosmic time. There have been literally billions of years. You know, the Earth, our solar system is a third generation star system by all accounts. So there was time available for entire generations of stars and planets to form, rise, go through their whole lifespan, get blown up, get redistributed. A second wave shows up. They go through their 5 billion year lifespan. They get blown up. And then we show up on scene. And human beings have only been on the planet for the tiniest sliver of time that the Earth itself has been here and that life has been here. So the idea that we've evolved to a technological state at this very narrow sliver of time, which happens to be the exact same time that some other life is also alive and not extinct, and, you know, because 99% of the life that has ever evolved on Earth is extinct. That's how much life has come up and flourished and been killed. By environmental impact, you know, cosmic, you know, asteroids, stuff like that. It is highly coincidental to say that we happen to be here at the exact moment that they, whoever they are, these extraterrestrials, hypothetical extraterrestrials, are also here. I think it's far more likely that we would find artifacts of a long lost civilization of extraterrestrials billions of years ago, maybe floating through the galaxy or left on planets or moons. And that's why I think xenoarchaeology is a much more important focus based on the same assumptions that, yeah, life is possible, we may run into it, than even astrobiology, because our rovers are looking for life, evidence of life on Mars. But Mars has such a tumultuous history that it may not have had water for a billion years. Well, that causes a problem for life as we know it. So we may be looking for, you know, tens of millions of year old fossils or relic artifacts. And I really think based on this idea of deep time, which is what they call it, we're going to find evidence of life, like evidence of extinct life, way before we happen to hit that lucky strike and find life that happens to actually be alive while we're alive.
Right. Now, I want to get more into that because it's extremely fascinating. And I do agree. I'm one of those who agrees with you, and some people may get frustrated that we haven't, as far as researchers, met that bar to say there is definitive physical evidence that not even close at this point. That's why I like the Kimmler case, because he's gotten maybe the closest, at least he's moving towards it. And some people get frustrated by that, mostly because some of the things you've mentioned, it's just they don't understand science. They say, well, you know, so-and-so has this piece of metal, or this person has this. True, people have things that they allege are X, Y, or Z, but they haven't done the proper analysis to prove that it's what they claim it to be.
Right.
And they're not even moving in that direction, where at least Kimmler is moving towards finding an answer.
Right, and that's exactly, like I said, those are the ideas I wanted to help promote, which is just like people in the past have come out with viewer's guides to help UFO hunters or, you know, amateur astronomers figure out what it is they're looking for. You know, what do meteors look like when they're streaking through the sky? Can they burn different colors? You know, what do lights look like? What sorts of mirages can the atmosphere produce? So those are all sort of a sighting guide. And what Kimmler has done, and what I also similarly would like to promote, is there's, you know, physical science parallel sort of guide that's possible, where what would you need to do to prove that something on the ground is from out of this world? And that's what Kimmler's done. He's taken some of those tools and he's applied them and at least started the process of, if you really wanted to say this piece of metal came from another planet, that's exactly how you would have to approach it if you ever wanted to get there.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's a science level, and I think that's what's interesting. That's, and it is important that there are two different levels, though, of compelling information, because of course the Holy Grail, at least for many, and I think is really important personally, and obviously you do too, is to get some science. However, there is what you mentioned, the personally compelling.
Right.
And what did you find personally compelling?
Well, you know, it's difficult territory for me because to me, you know, I know, as and there have been studies as the day is long, that show that humans are utterly terrible data recording mechanisms. I mean, not only are our memories malleable, they change over time, but the way, you know, accident investigations show this all the time. Two people are staring at the exact same wreck or shooting or, you know, whatever the event was, and they have completely different accounts of what it is they saw because they were focused on different things, they were susceptible to emotion. So for me, I can't, and again, this is my background, maybe I've been hopelessly biased by my training as a scientist, but I can't take human testimony as anything other than a suggestion. I can't reach into their mind and replay what it is they're telling me. I just have to take the words out of their mouth and assume not only that they're accurately describing their memories, but that their memories are even accurate that they're describing. So,
but there is, I mean, that you went and to your mom's at Christmas and your family was there. I mean, you don't need minute details for that.
Sure.
One person seeing something and that, oh, that's very... But I mean, I guess... Because, for instance...
I'm not saying I don't ever believe anyone. Like, you know, the more general you get, the more likely it is because you've essentially increased your error bars on your own recollection.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to me, human testimony is suggestions. It gives me something to look for with physical evidence. So, you know, it's a guide for me. Mm-hmm. But as far as taking it at face value, it's very difficult for me. I mean, look at how many people in history. I mean, I know this is drifting into philosophy, but look at how many people in history claim to have visions and sightings of the Greek gods, for instance. Well, we today know they don't even exist. And you have entire, you know, civilizations fought and died based on sightings and recollections of things that today we just shrug off. So at least these are the things that bother me as a scientist and that are always sort of tickling the back of my mind when I'm listening to human recollections of an event, especially one that is fantastic. I mean, it's one thing to say, I went to the store and I picked up some milk. Okay, fine. But if you say, I went to the store and all the milk was floating at the top of the store, well, all of a sudden that's fantastic. And so I'm going to need a lot more to take me there to actually believe that what you're telling me is true. So, you know, there were a few cases with witnesses that, I thought, even they don't have an obvious reason to lie. They're not asking for monetary, you know, compensation for giving the interview, and something probably happened, I think, in a few of these cases. But that's why they had me on the show. In order for me to begin to say what, I'm going to need something I can wrap my hands around, because up until then, I have no idea what they saw.
Mm-hmm. So I guess one case in particular, because
do you have one in mind?
I guess, yeah, the Travis Walton. Because
right.
In this case, you do have multiple witnesses of something strange.
Right. Well, I'm certainly not alleging anything, and I based on the way that we approached the show, I actually didn't know where we were going or who we were talking to until right. Or we went there because I'm not an actor and they wanted to keep our reactions fresh, but it had the unfortunate side effect of keeping me scrambling to catch up while we were there and then doing, all my analysis and research on the fly. And, at least while we were, you know, standing there, I'm genuinely, when I'm interviewing these guys on camera is literally the first time I've heard their stories.
Wow.
So, it was pretty incredible for me. And with Travis Walton, you know, there are aspects of the story that are compelling, of course. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's weird. I mean, I'm not going to lie. And that's why it's such a fantastic story. I mean, what's the alternative? Either something happened to Travis out in the woods and his buddy saw it, or the only other alternative is they had to all get together and decide to lie about it together.
Mm-hmm.
Go down in history as, you know, one of the biggest hoaxes, if you want to call it that, of all time. And either of those options are fantastic, you know. And which one is more fantastic? Well, I don't know. You know, I tend to lean toward their hoaxing versus aliens have traveled here just because in the complete absence of evidence, how do you cross either of those gulfs of question marks? But, you know, they all passed lie detector tests, and granted the lie detector tests were focused on more on did you kill Travis or is Travis dead, which in either case wouldn't be true because they wouldn't know, or they knew he was alive when they were in on it. Except for the last question, which was, did you see a UFO? You know, could all of them defeat that last question if they were in on it together? I don't know. And I'm by no means alleging that they made it up and are trying to hoax somebody. That's not what I'm saying, but just sort of, you know, Lady Justice weighing the scales. That's why we went out there to look for something else to try and corroborate aspects of Travis's story.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's one difficult thing. I could see why they would bring you out there to have you have some genuine reactions, but it makes it, especially in a case like this, it's impossible for you to have anything. It would be impossible for you to really even begin to know what to investigate because there's so much to this case that you would have to know a lot before going into it. That's what I guess it's unfortunate in a way because, of course, no police chief is going to take his investigator and say, okay, I'm not going to tell you anything about this until we get there. And then you're going to meet the witness and then, you know.
Right.
So.
You know, yeah, I did feel like that I was a little disadvantaged from that perspective. But at the same time, you know, I know how to look for physical evidence. I mean, that's something that we do all the time. So ultimately, what are you asking? You know, if something whizzes through the air, I mean, is there any evidence left behind if a Cessna flies overhead?
Right.
No.
Right.
So, you know, if an alien spacecraft just does a flyby and zaps somebody, well, there's not really going to be any evidence left behind. But, you know, we at least ran with the hypothesis that, okay, if there was a spacecraft there, maybe there were some sort of radio effects on, you know, some neutron activation of metals in the soil, maybe, which would leave a radiation signature you could detect later on, which is diagnostic. I mean, there are a few ways that the environment can be fundamentally affected by energy sources in proximity. And, you know, use that to at least rule against. And so I think we can rule out that an unshielded nuclear reactor, fission reactor, was sitting nearby.
Mm-hmm.
So that if someone's proposing a spacecraft hovered there, well, it was either well shielded or it wasn't using a fission reactor. But it's, you know, it's hard to actually come up with something to search for to corroborate the story. And then what do you do if at the end of the day you're left with no evidence and just this guy's account? For me, that's not enough to get me there.
Well, and especially with someone you just met. I mean, it's unfortunate. It's one of the things then, it's another thing that makes frustrating because that's not really fair at all towards this case, really. I mean, to really examine this case, you would need to also talk with the other witnesses, I think, and then talk with other people involved.
Right, and if again we were zeroing in on the physical evidence aspect, so getting out to the site and then trying to, you know, uncover evidence of something. So there, I guess.
Well, you would have to examine the other investigations also, where people did look for physical evidence, because that has happened in the past.
Right, we actually.
There would be a lot of research that would need to be done first.
Right, and we were at the location. That's how we knew we were at the right spot. We were at the location where other tree cores were taken. We could see that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, I wasn't in on a lot of the design of this stuff, which is unfortunate. Not for lack of wanting. It's just not the way
right.
the project was set up. And, I mean, I agree with you. I would have loved to have been involved from square one through the whole thing and helped set up some of these surveys because, frankly, in a lot of cases, I was really rushed. Because, you know, I don't think sometimes there was an understanding about, like, science isn't a light switch. It's not like, go science.
Yeah, go so, okay, do science.
Exactly, and there were some times, frankly, where I felt that's kind of like what happened. I mean, the whole crew is there, and they go, okay, go. You've got
do some science.
You've got an hour. And, you know, that's
yeah.
There's only so much that I can do without the context and then getting this fresh and, you know, real time. But we made a decent stab at it, and we were able to rule some things out, which isn't going to answer the whole puzzle, but it'll certainly put, you know, more information into the mix that you can use to, you know, if you can get there with physical data, it's something you can use to help get you to the whatever the answer is.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't anything you found compelling in it, scientifically or personally.
I guess I've been talking around it.
That's okay. I mean, if that's the case, that's the case.
There was nothing that I encountered that I couldn't rationalize, or at least wasn't an option on the table as somebody not recognizing what it was that they saw, or there may have been deception, you know, something like that. I would really have loved to have found something that was so compelling that it took me there, but I hadn't seen it yet.
But I mean, you're open to the possibility enough to at least entertain or to aid. Like, for instance, if I said, hey, I think I might have something here that is interesting, you'd be open to listening and helping me out, I guess.
Sure. I mean, that's why I did the project in the first place.
And that's what's important, at least, is that people are open.
Yeah, and you know, I say that with all respect. I'm not trying to slander anybody or accuse anyone.
Oh, totally understood.
You know, it's just for me. Let me put it in the context where I come from. Even things like cold fusion, or climate change, or the Higgs boson, in order to prove that those exist or don't exist, that the process exists. It takes so much time and so much data of diligently ruling out other alternatives, being utterly meticulous, having other people follow you up and be equally meticulous before concluding that something is true, especially if it's strange. And so when you have a claim like this, which is could be argued to be the strangest claim we've got, is that alien life has developed technologically advanced stuff that we don't have and they are here. To conclude that, in my mind, you know, I'm going through the same level of rigor. You've got, you know, decades of particle research in particle accelerators before scientists even declare that we may have found it, you know, and that's the level of rigor that I think people need to bring if they're serious about really believing that aliens are here. That's the level of rigor they need to bring to the discussion, or else that's what turns scientists off and why they wave their arms so quickly and say, wow, there's no such thing.
Right. And I agree. That's why I think it's important that we have someone like you to rely on. Or I had another gentleman who was also a physicist and did some work in astrobiology a few weeks ago, and he was a skeptic also. But I think it's important because we need to know, we need help on where to go, where the bar really is, and because I just totally, totally agree that, you know, this is, you got to prove your point. You can't just say this is what it is and go with that. To your point also, those things that you mentioned, like even the Higgs boson, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, I mean, those aren't foregone conclusions. Those are, even though in the public mind, something like dark matter is for sure, or some of these other things, they are really at this point still hypotheses that are being worked on, being proven.
Right. And I think that's another great point that not a lot of people, it's not regularly communicated, is that in the sciences, something is not really true or false. It's held in sort of a, you kind of suspend these ideas in a probability cloud. So, you know, how close are we to proving the Higgs boson exists? Maybe we're up to 80% now. So, you know, it's like increasing or decreasing levels of might, which is all based on the data and the error. So, I mean, it's not a very simple way to look at the universe, but there are all sorts of competing ideas out there which could still be true. I mean, there could still be you know, quantum mechanics or subatomic, subnuclear particle reasons that it's not the Higgs boson that people are seeing evidence for, but something else that could produce the same evidence. And that's what you keep making new experiments to try and rule those out. And that's that, back to that attacking your hypothesis kind of mentality, so that, you know, as the research progresses, you slowly get closer to being 100% certain that this is the way something is. But all the way up until then, like, look at Newton and gravity. He was wrong. He wasn't all the way wrong, but Kepler came along after Newton and found out that Newton's gravity as applied to planet orbits produces the wrong orbits. So then you get Kepler, who worked out the geometry of orbits, and that's Kepler's laws. And so Newton was mostly right, but Kepler fixed it. But then when we got really, really detailed about orbits, we discovered that Kepler was also a little bit wrong. And Einstein came by and found a solution to correct for an error in Mercury's orbit. So, you know, Newton was mostly right, and then Kepler was really, really mostly right, and then Einstein was really, really mostly right about orbits and gravity. And so there's still room for our understanding of gravity and the way that planets orbit to be a sliver wrong. But that's the sort of, do we say that Newton was wrong? Well, no, because he was mostly right. And that's the way that, that science considers any concept. It's that there's always room, you know, Kepler and Einstein didn't turn Newton on his head. The idea of gravity is still perfectly sound, but in different scenarios, they'd be wrong. And so, you know, you bring this mentality to the idea that people are seeing things in the sky that they don't explain, or that, you know, they can't explain, or that they're having experiences that they don't understand. And are they, how certain can you be about what they are? Are there things that are similar or different about them? Or are they being connected simply because they're question marks? And that's one of the dangers, I think, that I saw doing the show, was that it's really tempting if you find something unexplained right next to something else unexplained to say they're both the same thing. But it could be, I mean, look at like radar pings for UFOs. So say you got a sighting and then you got a weird radar signal. Well, did you happen, which was first? Did you get the radar hit first or did you get the sighting first? And did you interpret the other one based on the, you know, the first anomaly that you saw? I mean, the way I phrased the question was, do you tend to see UFOs on radar at the exact same rate that you tend to see malfunctions in radar? In which case, you may actually just be seeing a malfunction and attaching it to a light that you didn't expect. And together, it makes a really compelling story, but that's a human frailty. And, you know, we're connecting those dots, not the data isn't connecting it itself. And so that's that level of rigor. That's what you really, if you want to convince a scientist, you need to prove to a scientist not just that there was a radar hit and a sighting. You need to prove to the scientist that the two were related, and you need to rule out that the radar hit couldn't have been something different than the sighting.
Well, and although at the same time, at least my goal is, I'm not going to prove anything to a scientist. I'm not a scientist. I don't have those expertise. So hopefully, and that's the case when it comes to any phenomena, is that you have to have something compelling enough to get scientists to actually do that kind of work. So hopefully.
Right, and I didn't mean you personally. I just.
Oh, I know what you mean, but.
Trying to help illustrate why it is that there's so much headbutting that goes on, because I like to try and sit in the middle. I'm not out to prove anyone wrong, or I'm trying to help. And. You know, it's the idea, someone comes and says, well, we got this on radar and we saw it. And the first question, and this is back to attacking your hypothesis, is, are you sure? I mean, there's the Mexico
right.
FLIR footage analysis, for instance. Based on the geometry of that scenario, if you consider the lights to actually have been the burning stacks on the oil platforms out in the Campeche Gulf there in the off the Yucatan, then that actually predicts one of those lights turning into two because they're actually lined up one right behind the other. And that's exactly what you see in the footage. So to me, it would be nearly impossible to propose that you've got, you know, a fleet of alien spaceships who are sitting in the exact same position as the lights of the oil wells that is even predicted by the geometry. But people go, well, wait, there were three of them on radar. And my first question was it those lights? Because those lights were, if according to the scenario, 100 miles away. And the distance to the radar pings, I've never heard anyone say, was anywhere near 100 miles away. So that, in my mind, is probably a case of radar pinging much smaller craft in between, you know, their position and the lights they were seeing. And they were zoomed way past whatever these radar hits were and looking lights on the horizon. But in the moment, they connected the two. And I mean, because there were 11 lights and only three radar hits. So already we know something's wrong. That kind of rigor, don't just stop when you say, well, we saw it on radar, we're good. It's like, we saw it on radar. What did we see on radar? Why? Are we sure it's the same thing? And really sink your teeth into it.
Right. Now, I want to move on, though, too, because we're running out of time, is the xenoarchaeology, which I think is just so extremely interesting. It reminds me of Prometheus, which I'm sure you probably, at least I would assume that you liked the movie because it was a lot of fun. I mean, just imagining, you know, coming in this craft, which was a commercial, you know, spacecraft that they land in, and there's these pyramids, and they're doing some xeno-archaeology there. That is a interesting concept, and, you know, I hadn't heard that term until I heard it from you, and it was something really almost that Paul Davies had even proposed with doing something similar on the moon and looking with photographs there.
Yeah, it's, you know, the idea, like I mentioned earlier, is just that I firmly believe we're going to come across evidence of extinct life, whatever that is, before we come across evidence of living life. And as just a virtue of the fact that there's so much time involved, you know, based on that, there no archaeologist would be immediately prepared to perform archaeology on another planet because the gravity, the temperature, the pressure, the elemental composition, weathering is all different. And so their sense of context, things we take for granted, it would be completely out the window. And on the flip side, no planetary scientist would be adequately trained in archaeological forensics to figure out, you know, what this Martian, what for all looks like a Martian arrowhead, is it actually an arrowhead? I like to use the example that when designing drill bits for Mars rovers that were doing, you know, surface composition analysis work, the actual angle and sharpness of the drill bits had to be drastically changed because the pressure is so light on Mars. I mean, right now we can think about 17 miles of air sitting on top of us, kind of pressing us down. And when you cut something with a knife, you're using your force, but also the weight of all that air, the pressure, is helping you cut. Well, on Mars, that pressure is all but gone. And so if you took a normal drill bit to Mars and put it up against a rock, it wouldn't cut. So they actually had to completely redesign drill bits so that they would actually cut on Mars. So the point there is just because something looks like an arrowhead, it looks like a cutting surface, for instance, on Mars, it may not actually work like that at all. So you cannot use your human eyes if you actually wanted to attempt to interpret something in a different planetary environment. And that's why I thought, well, heck, we're going to come across something sometime that we're going to think is actually an artifact or a fossil. And it doesn't matter if it turns out to be one or not to me. We have to have a rigorous methodology in place before then so we can go through the process correctly and good data at the end. So my point was not that I think we're going to find artifacts on Mars. My point was we're sending so many craft out there, we are soon going to come across something that we think might be an artifact somewhere that we have to be ready to perform a real analysis on it. And, you know, you could make the argument that you've got Hoagland's, the pyramids in Cydonia on Mars and the face on Mars, which has been pretty conclusively shown to be pareidolia and just a regular rodent. But the point is, even there, we've already come across things that people have thought were evidence of something, and it would sure be nice to have a rigorous methodology in place if we find something more up close and personal to go through the process and make sure we don't bias the heck out of ourselves.
Right, because I would assume that, so for instance, the rovers we send up there probably are not equipped to do any archaeological work, whereas future robots that we may want to send, we will need to, or if we find the need to, possibly fit with this sort of gear. So what would they need to be able to do any work there?
Well, exactly, and that's what developing this methodology will help answer. So right now, you know, no one's really addressed those questions. Like, what instrumentation would you want that you don't have on a rover if you were going to try and archaeologically survey a site? And we don't know, you know, that nobody's actually done the work yet. And so no doubt it would be very similar to what archaeologists use, but it may not. And so, you know, I'm working on some follow-up work with some other archaeologists and space archaeologists who in most cases are working on our own evidence out in the universe, like preserving the Apollo 11 landing site as a sort of a global historical landmark. But the same sorts of ideas apply. And, you know, I think I really tried to not be speculative about it. I mean, I wasn't out there on the hilltop saying that, you know, there are pyramids on Mars. But that's and it's something that I had to really worry about, because there was some negative feedback that came back. People actually accused me of saying that, which is the farthest thing from the truth. But I think there are good reasons, based on that deep time argument, to believe that astrobiology is a fully functioning field right now, and we have not yet found any alien life. SETI research is in full force right now, and we have found no conclusive evidence of an alien civilization. So for other scientists to toss out xenoarchaeology, which is based on the exact same assumptions that alien life is probably evolved and maybe out there, I think the physics and the math actually weighs toward xenoarchaeology being developed first.
Right, that makes perfect sense. And it was a similar argument that Paul David had said, was that if at any time in the last few thousands of years anything's been on the moon, then that evidence may still be there. And maybe that's what we need to look for, other than something there right now.
Right. Well, you know, you've got a low erosional environment like that. I mean, you've got the surface of the moon is getting attacked by solar radiation, but that's about it. And occasional impacts, which may slowly bury things over time with layers of impact ejecta.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, yeah, you said something on the moon. I mean, heck, that's why I hate to go to science fiction, but that's why Arthur C. Clarke put his monument on the moon in 2001. Because it was a long-lived, stable environment that an alien species thought would be the perfect place to put a marker when humanity was ready for it. And, of course, this is very fantastic and very optimistic, really. I mean, it'd be nice for aliens to have come to us and park things here so we can just find them. But, you know, it's the same – it's developing the tools that hypothetically – well, eventually, you know, if humanity survives – eventually, we're going to have xenoarchaeologists out there.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of time. How soon? I don't know. But, I mean, I would hope sooner rather than later. I mean, that's the irony with all this. Well, I didn't find anything personally compelling doing the show to prove to me that aliens are here. But you don't get involved in space science because you think nothing's going on in the universe.
Yeah.
You know, and so I really see the people who are very, you know, in a social level interested in UFOs, and scientists who are studying astrobiology or xenoarchaeology or planetary geology are really following the same desire. You know, we're really asking the exact same questions, except the only difference is, you know, how much do you want to contain your hypothesis first, and how rigorously do you want to actually get out there and restrict yourself to the data and wait for that to tell you what the reality is. And so ultimately, I don't think that we're all so different. And that's what I tried to do by participating in the show, was to illustrate that, yes, we go into, you know, James Fox and I go into a scenario. He is utterly compelled. He's there as soon as he finds a credible witness, which is, I'm not saying that as a slight. It's just not the perspective of a scientist. And to kind of bridge the waters between a compelling human story and what it takes to make a scientific conclusion, that's one of the things I wanted to help promote, and developing methodologies like xenoarchaeology, or doing the things that Kimbler was doing, which are used by geologists to determine extraterrestrial material. That's what you need to get there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned there was a tie behind commercial space flight and xenoarchaeology. Do you believe that it will be the private industry that will be the first people to do this sort of work?
Well, frankly, I think that commercial space flight is going to be responsible for all of the big risky missions that we ultimately undertake. It's personal opinion, but I don't think that governments are ever going to be put, unless we're at war, under the threat of war, they will never accept the risk necessary to do frontier planetary exploration work. So, but venture capitalists risk that kind of money all the time. So if you make a business case for a company to spend that kind of money, like Planetary Resources and mining asteroids, there was an article that came back, and I cannot remember the author's name, came out a couple years ago, alleging that one of the ways we could look for evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence is to look for mined asteroids. So they're ideal resource pockets. and you don't have to take the resources out of gravity well. And there are a lot of reasons to think that once you're already out in space, asteroids are ideal mining spots. So he basically said we should be looking for mine shafts on asteroids. You know, I think that certainly weighs toward the idea that, yeah, it'll be commercial industry that takes us out there. And so, yes, I think it'll be commercial astronauts who are the ones on the front line that are encountering a lot of this stuff first. And then I think that may provide the support for governments to say, okay, well, we need to send a dedicated international science mission out to really take care of this. But no, I think commercial astronauts are the future.
Wow. That's fun. It's interesting because it lends also to that world that's in Aliens or other sci-fi movies where, you know, you've got these guys out there working, you know, they're putting in a 6-month contract on a spaceship or on an asteroid to go do some work, and they're down there with their space drills and everything.
Right. It's like it's a gritty space reality. It's not the high-minded ideal of you know, white ships and the right stuff.
Right.
That's actually one of the things. The name of my company is called Astro Right, and one of the fun. We tried to coin a meme, which is right, W-R-I-G-H-T, in the sense of a playwright or an old shipwright,
mm-hmm.
someone that makes something. So instead of an astronaut, we were considering the future of commercial space involving astrowrights, people who go up there not to just go up there, but who go up there to work.
Right.
So being an astrowright, different than an astronaut, a star sailor, an astrowright would be a star worker. Star builder.
Wow.
So anyway, that's the name of the company. I really think that's the direction the future is going.
That's really cool, and it's a perfect place to end. AstroWright with a W.com is your website where you guys do your spaceflight consulting, and really exciting stuff. I think right now you've got to be really excited, especially with the last 4 years in this policy of moving, privatizing, you know, the space flight and everything. We're in some really exciting times this way, I think.
You know it. I feel totally vindicated because I've been saying since I was in high school the future is going to be corporate space, and it's actually finally happening.
Right. And who would have known even 5 years ago that would be the case?
Well, there was some writing on the wall. Like I said, the idea of venture capital getting us out there faster than government can do it. That's what I've been banking on for a long time now.
And it is amazing how quick they moved. I did not expect that. Now we have, maybe 4 or 5 commercial craft ready to start to go up. I mean, it's boomed.
Yeah, more than that even. So cross your fingers, assuming no major accidents, this could all really happen in the next 10 years.
Right, very exciting. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Definitely a great learning experience for me. And I just love this stuff.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to be on, as always.
One good dude, that Ben McGee. So that was a lot of fun. And, that's me, dude. I don't know. Maybe my next life I want to be on that ship descending into, you know, the extraterrestrial planet onto some archaeological effects to discover, and very, very exciting stuff. Although, if you look at Aliens, those corporations running things were not fair. And if you look at defense contractors now, like the stuff they were doing at Area 51, burning the nuclear waste, or, you know, I used to live near Rocky Flats where they had plutonium dust in the vents and everything. So these guys hopefully clean up their act, although we should not bet on that. So it might make for treacherous work. Perhaps they will feel their workers are expendable. But then again, that happens on this planet, huh? Anyway. Thank you so much, Ben, for being on the show. If you want some aerospace consulting, you can talk to Ben at astrowright.com. If you want the latest in UFO news, then you can go to ufodailynews.com and especially look at the daily news feed, which is a Twitter feed. And one of the things you'll see there is a tweet from GoDaddy, because GoDaddy got hacked and got taken down for a period of time. So did many of their sites, including mine. So I did get a couple messages. Hey, man, your site's down. Not anymore. It's up and running, and we are G2G. That's good to go. So we'll talk to you next week. Thank you so much for joining me. It's always lovely to have you. You have a wonderful week, my friends.